Accession number 18795, Real One.
This is a recording of an interview with Tony Wilcox, recorded on April the 13th, 1999, by Rodney Giesler for the Imperial War Museum Sound Archive, Reel 1. Running? Yes. Tony, I usually, to start an interview by asking when and where you were born and a bit about your family background.
Yeah. Mm. Okay.
So you could tell me.
Right. Well, I was born in a little place called Hackbridge, which is now a part of the Sutton and Wallington council area, on the 3rd of July 1926. Born at home, because it was one of the things that I think occurred more often in those days than it does now. Family, my father was an official in an insurance company, the Legal and General. He dated back almost to the days when, as a clerk when he joined, they were standing at desks, the high desks, with ledgers, rather than sitting down, and they had a supervisor who kept them on literally on their toes all the time. And my mother, before she married, came... My father was from, originally, I think, from the Chatham area. His father was born in that area, and his father was an official in the bankruptcy court, Carey Street, I think they called it. My mother came from a little village in Staffordshire called Winsfield, and she, before she married, was a hairdresser. But after she married, she was a housewife and mother. Unlike, again, the modern girls, wives stayed at home and looked after the children. They didn't work.
I believe your father was with the Royal Flying Corps one time, wasn't he?
No, not the Royal. No, yeah. He was in the Great War he was an officer in the, what they call it, the Royal Army Service Corps, uh-huh. And he, as he put it, drove Model Ts largely between Baghdad, Basra, over to Tehran. It certainly in the Middle East. He wasn't in the European theatre at all. I'm trying to think of the name of the force that he was in, but it was...
That was in what was known as Mesopotamia, wasn't it?
That was him, certainly, yes. I'm trying to think of the book that he had, which was the title. The title was With the MT in Mesopotamia. And it's an interesting book. I mean, he's got quite a lot of old photographs of the old Model Ts going backwards and forwards and stuck in the sand.
He wrote this book, did he?
Oh, no, but he's mentioned in it.
When you sort of started to take a view of life, what did you want to do with your life? When you were at school, for instance, did you have your eye on a career of any sort?
No, I think you have to look back to the time I started my secondary school in 1937, at which time it was becoming fairly obvious that a war was likely, and I really hadn't any idea of what I wanted to do. But I just sort of went through the normal curriculum and passed the matriculation, went into the sixth form, but I suppose with an emphasis on chemistry and physics, science, rather than languages. I did normal schoolboy French, But and then, of course, come 1939, with the outbreak of war, at which I was 39, I would have been 13. One didn't think about a career at all, and I joined the cadets at school, and I suppose in those days I really wanted to join the RAF, but I was very dubious as to whether I would pass the medical examination, A, because I, at school I'd been quite a bad asthmatic, and also I needed glasses, so I had quite bad astigmatism. So as it developed during my school time, I suppose my ideas switched to the army, where I was fairly certain I would get in, and to tanks. That was the intention. I was lucky enough at school when I was 17 to be accepted for what they called the university short course, and went up to, this was an army scheme, and went up to Oxford, Exeter College for 6 months, which was a very pleasant, very easy, because really I wasn't doing any more than I had already done at school in the sixth form.
It was an academic course,
wasn't it? It was an academic course. I suppose 75% academic and 25% army in the Oxford University training, or senior training corps they called it then, as opposed to the junior training corps at school. They taught us the basics of driving and how to shoot a gun and how to polish brass and boots and things. That was a very enjoyable period. That was the time, I'm trying to remember that. No, it was before the Arnhem.
It would have been about 1943, wouldn't it?
Yes, 43, April 43, I went on the university short course and finished in the October, and went, I think they would call it a cultural shock now, from Oxford to a primary training centre, which was literally 4 weeks of absolute hard square mashing. Nothing else. They didn't attempt to teach us anything other than discipline and marching.
Being shouted at.
and living in fairly rough barracks.
Where was this?
I'm trying to think. I knew you were going to ask that. It was... Oh, dear, where was it? In the Midlands somewhere. But it only lasted 4 weeks, and it was really to make us look like soldiers. Before we went to the RAC Primary Training Centre at Farnborough, Kent, by the airport, by Farnborough Airport, I think that was 3 months, armoured training. Basic, very basic armoured training.
What was that, driving tanks around and things? Or?
No. I have to go back a bit.
Which Farnborough are we talking about? It is
Farnborough. Farnborough Airport. Well, the
RAE is.
The RAE, that's right. Yes, yes. There was a Royal Armoured Corps primary training centre there.
Yeah.
And we went there. And then that was really a first, I suppose, screening process, because it was, having been selected for the university short course, it was hoped that we would all be, quote, officer material, and that was the first selection, and majority of people made it through there, and then we went from there straight to Sandhurst, to the pre-octu at Sandhurst. Pre-octu, RAC pre-octu and RAC octu were both at Sandhurst,
That's Royal Armoured Corps.
That's Royal Armoured Corps. Mm. And let's see now, the 6 months of pre-octu, and this was everything from, I mean, basics, driving tanks, gunnery, tactics, man management, map reading, the lot of the sort of things that we were going to be required to do, and was followed by 6 months of octu. Pre-octu was again a weeding out process, and I think the majority, I mean, well over 80% got through pre-octu, and again I would think something over 80% got through octu at Sandhurst. I was unlucky, if that's the way to call it, in that we were the first intake, I suppose, that did not actually pass out from Sandhurst with all the ceremony of the adjutant on his grey and climbing up the steps of the main building, because they closed down the RAC pre-octu at octu at Sandhurst and moved down to Bovington, and they did their best to create some sort of ceremony, but it was really sort of marching off the parade ground in between a couple of barrack huts. So, but it was okay, and I was commissioned as a second lieutenant in December 45. Octu, that's right, I was trying to think back. Octu, it was while I was at Octu that we had the Arnhem. I can clearly remember all the planes and gliders flying over.
That was September 44 then?
That was September 44. That would have been pre-Octu, that's right. And then I went to Octu in, must have been February, March, when we were just coming up to VE Day, because I was at Sandhurst at the Octu for VE Day.
VE Day.
VE Day.
Not the Normandy landings.
No. Wait a minute. Now, where was I for the Normandy landings? Golly.
You said you were commissioned finally in December 45. Was it after the war?
This was just after the end of the war. Mm. Yes. No, I'm trying to get the timing right on this. The Normandy landings were in 44, weren't they?
June
44.
Yeah.
So I would have been... yes, I would have been at I think I'd been at Farnborough for the Normandy landings. Funnily enough, the Normandy landings don't leave as big a memory as the Arnhem landings. I think the only conscious thing I have of the Normandy landings is the incredible number of vehicles parked along all the roads in the area, and particularly in my home area at Purley. We'd moved before the war from Hackbridge to Purley, and which was a more countrified area around Red Hill, Reigate, that sort of area. A lot of transport, all ready to move. Right, where were we?
Now you were commissioned in December 45.
December 45.
Into which regiment?
Into the 1721st Lancers. Yes, I had to have various interviews to get into the 1721st. Why did I elect for the 1721st? It was a cavalry regiment, and I was very interested in riding. It was known to be a good regiment. So I had an interview with colonel of the regiment. Anyway, I was accepted, I'm not sure why. But having been commissioned into December, I had Christmas at home. The only thing I remember about that Christmas is that two great friends of mine, one had just been commissioned in the Navy, and the other had just been commissioned in the Air Force. And the three of us went to midnight communion in our uniforms. And we all thought we were absolute bee's knees in our new uniforms at midnight communion. What
sort of commission had you signed on for as a
regiment? No, this was a war emergency commission.
Still hostilities only?
Yes, that's right. It was a war emergency commission, hostilities only. Then I was sent up to Catterick for 5 weeks, and I think that was just a holding operation, really, while they organised things to get us out to the regiment. And my regiment was in Greece at that time, part of the 4th British Division, the Dutch Cheese Division. The divisional emblem was rather like a quarter of a Dutch cheese. And I went by train from Calais down through France into Italy, and we went to a staging camp in Novara, just northeast of Milan. From Milan we went to Naples and joined an old Liberty ship which had been fitted out as a troop ship, the Empire Hayward, and we sailed from there via Piraeus to Salonika. That was probably one of my rougher sea journeys. We had very bad weather all the way, and old Liberty ships didn't have anything in the way of stabilizers, or so we were being thrown about a bit there. However, we made it eventually to Salonika, and I joined the regiment in Salonika. We were stationed in the old Greek cavalry barracks out on the headland. That was from, what, must have been January 46. And I was there until the regiment moved to re-equip in Fide, on the Great Bitter Lakes. Cassassine, I think it was called, actually, not Fide. So,
what was the regiment doing in Greece?
Now, the regiment really was, I think, showing the flag. Greece was in turmoil, but with Elas on the one side and I think it was Erap on the other side. There was almost a civil war going on. There were a lot of, I suppose one might call, atrocities in little villages which were descended upon by one or other of these forces, and people were being wiped out. And it being a civil war, or virtually a civil war, we as such weren't at war with anybody, but we tried to make our presence known to deter these other forces from having a go at each other's throats. And
essentially one side was pro-communist and the other was anti, wasn't
it? That's right, yes, mm. Yes. We used to travel around. We were equipped with armoured cars in Greece, so we had a few Sherman tanks, but basically armoured
cars. These were Daimler armoured cars, wasn't
they? These were Daimler armoured cars, and we had a few Shermans. Mm. Not Shermans. We had a few Sherman tanks, we had Staghounds, which was the I think it was a British name for an American armoured car, but it was a very nice armoured car, the Staghound. Much better equipped than the British Daimlers and Humbers that we had. we also had the little Daimler Scout cars and the Humber Scout cars as well.
One of those was called a Dingo, I think, wasn't it?
No, that's right, the Daimler Dingo. One was the Daimler Dingo. The Humber was slightly unstable and likely to turn over, so one had to be a bit careful of that.
I was going to ask you if you can recall any particular incidents that you...
Well, I took my troop up, and a troop was what, four armoured cars and a Dingo or a Humber Scout car in front. And we normally were only a troop at a time because we were covering the whole of Macedonia then, or at least the Greek part called Macedonia, which was the northern part of Greece, which stretched to the Turkish frontier. And I drove it, took the troop right up to the Turkish frontier, through places called Ceres and Alexandropolis and... Yeah. And we saw nothing, but at least we hoped that our presence was seen and noted by people in the area. We went up to Drama and Xanthi, up to the Bulgarian border. It was unexciting, but I think effective. One wasn't going to be able to stop everything happening, but I think it was considered to be doing a useful job.
Was it an armoured division that you were with, or just a...
No, it was the 4th British Infantry Division.
Oh, yes, you
and we were the armoured regiment attached to the India, to the infantry division. I'm trying to remember some of the other infantry battalions who were with us, but I'm afraid that's gone.
I mean, when you were operating on these patrols, I mean, what sort of support did you have as far as rations and things like that were concerned?
We'd carried everything with us, and we slept on the ground. I mean, we weren't in accommodation anywhere on these things. We were away for a week at a time. We took all our rations with us. We cooked in the open air, and we slept in the open air.
And you were in radio contact with your headquarters?
And we were in radio contact with the headquarters, that's right. And we could have... I think we could have had support fairly quickly had we run into real trouble. We never did run into real trouble.
You had air cover there, presumably?
Air cover there, yes. It was not a war situation as such. I mean, I suppose in some ways it was a bit like Northern Ireland has been. Except that we weren't directly the enemy. We were in
There's a sort of echo of it in Salonika now, isn't there? You've got a military presence there.
Yes.
Macedonia.
Well, that's right. Yeah. Yes. Mm. Yes. Yes.
How long were you there then?
Must have been just about a year. Just about a year. And I say, we then moved to Egypt to re-equip before being sent to Palestine. And the regiment moved to... the port on the Sea of Galilee.
On the Sea of Galilee?
It'll come back to me. It'll come back to me. And the regiment was there again in... This was coming up to the end of the mandate and trying to control the situation, as it was, between Arab and Jew. I think that in those days, I think a majority of the British troops out there sympathised more with the Arabs than with the Jewish side there. But that was not reflected in the role or the behaviour of the people. I think we tried to take a very even hand. One of our roles was to operate on the main line from Haifa down to Egypt, where trains were being constantly blown up by one side or the other, and we had some converted Marmon Harrington armoured cars, which had railway wheels instead of rubber tyres and used to trundle up and down the railway line in front of the trains. We always said to explode any mine before the train got there. I don't think that was the intention. The intention was to prevent mines being laid, but inevitably one or two people were blown up in those armoured cars. It helped keep the line open because it was a very light, a very important railway line, supplying a lot of the army's needs in Palestine from the main supply bases in the canal zone.
Do you recall any particular incidents where you had to intercede or where you got shot at? Or
no, not there. I was only in Tiberias, the name of the port, where the regiment based in Tiberias. I didn't do any actual journeys on the Marmon Harringtons, but I was down at their base for two or three weeks. But then I was sent from Tiberias to Jerusalem with two troops of armoured cars. And we were attached to the Palestine police as heavy support for Palestine police operations. And there it was more, there was more active service, there was more shooting around in the Jerusalem area than we had seen in Tiberias or the north of Palestine. There were parts that weren't no-go areas, but they were recognised as being fairly dangerous parts to go to. I had my 21st birthday party in Palestine while I was based in Jerusalem, and that we parked the armoured cars outside a little Arab cafe and went in and had a drink there, which was made a break. There were two things that I can stand out in my memory, I think. One was that it seemed to me a battle was raging, and we were asked to go in Jerusalem to help the Palestine police, and there was automatic fire coming from a house in Jerusalem. And we dismounted from the armoured cars and went forward through the garden right up to the house. And there was a lot of cover there. And we threw two or three grenades into the house, which stopped the firing. But I was immediately recalled and was in a lot of trouble for allowing the grenades to be thrown, and was told very politely that we were not at war with anybody and we might have been shot at from this house, but didn't mean to say we had the right to go and throw hand grenades into it. And that was a bit worrying at the time. I didn't know quite what was going to happen, but eventually I think everybody recognised that it was an uncomfortable situation and that perhaps throwing hand grenades into the building was not a totally totally
productive exercise.
Hmm?
Productive exercise.
Well, I wasn't thinking of that. It was not totally unexpected as a reaction sort of thing. I mean, it was a natural reaction on our part, I think. And I'd have done the same again. Anyway, that one went past. The next one was we were again on a patrol in the Jerusalem area, on the outskirts of Jerusalem, and one of these remote-controlled mines was set off. I was in a dingo, open-top Daimler scout car, and followed by three Daimler armoured cars. And the I suspect they were probably trying or hoping that it would go, and the mine would go off underneath my dinghy. In fact, it went off about 3 or 4 yards behind my dingo, and we were the car was thrown up into the air, and we were in fact thrown out of the dingo, and sadly my driver had a piece of shrapnel in his head, and it was unfortunate. We had to go through getting on for a week where he was in the hospital, and there was nothing anybody could do. He had a piece of shrapnel embedded deeply in the brain, and it was impossible to remove it.